I have to begin with a word of apology and also a word of gratitude. Gratitude because I have been given this opportunity to meet you all. It's a great privilege. I wish it could have been a great pleasure also, but for two facts. The first is that I have to speak to you in a language in which I seldom speak. And if I do speak at all, I speak it falteringly and indifferently. I don't command any felicity of expression in the English language. And the second fact is that I have been rather feeling out of sorts for the last few days. So I don't happen to have the proper mood for giving a talk which will be worthwhile in this distinguished gathering. I am conscious of the fact that I am talking to an audience which is known for its forensic eloquence and its formidable skill in argument. The chairman has been kind enough to present my credentials to you. I am not a lawyer in my own right, but somehow I can claim a vicarious kinship with you. My father was a district judge. My son is a high court judge. Another son is an advocate, and my grandson also is an advocate. So I have been surrounded by lawyers. The tradition is that lawyers are a difficult audience to convince or persuade. It was Socrates himself who said, who blamed reasoning, that they could make the worse appear the better reason. But so far as revolution is concerned, we have to change our attitudes in all walks of life. So with us, I mean with us the lawyers also. This is not mainly in a profession which is calculated to be a device for keeping the pot boiling, but also a vocation. And as a vocation, I think, from that point of view, every lawyer must become at least a tribune of the people. He should command not only their respect, but their confidence. As the general impression goes, lawyers are regarded as people who thrive on feuds. And in that, from that point of view, from that angle of vision, there are certain professions which must be regarded as antisocial. So far as the profession of the lawyer and the doctor is concerned, since the doctor lives on disease, on the illnesses of people, and the lawyer is supposed to live on feuds, thrive on feuds, they follow professions that are antisocial. But their professions could be converted into vocations if they become the real tribunes of the people. I am reminded of a parable. There was an election meeting, and each of the candidates was asked to present his manifesto in one sentence. So the priest rose first. "I preach for all." Then came the doctor. "I prescribe for all." Then came the lawyer. He wrote, "I plead for all." And then came the newspaper man. "I print and publish for all." Then came the economist. "I plan for all." The poor voter, who was sitting in a sequestered corner, came forward and wrote beneath all these manifestos, "I pay for all." He pays for all, but he cannot call the tune. The voter should be able to call the tune. That is the change we seek to bring about in the realm of politics. Politicians, as they go now, do everything except this. Dr. Johnson, in his bantering style, once described a politician in the following words: "He knows nothing, but he thinks he knows everything that points to a political career." Our politicians are running the whole show. They are ruling the roost, as it were. The politician has policed our literatures, our artists, and even our scientists. Even our saints and godmen pay obeisance to him. He seems to be the ruler of the world, of the modern world, and people look upon politicians as fragments of royalty, because every politician is trying to carve out a kingdom for himself, which he calls his pocket bureau or his constituency. So between politicians and lawyers, will the common man be lost? That's the question. Our quest in this revolution is to find out the common man and make him conscious of his power, whom Tagore called the lowest, lowliest, and the lost. Does he inherit God's earth? Has he any right over this earth? The law in its majesty drives him from post to pillar. The law forbids him to sleep under the bridge, to live on the pavement, to beg on the street, and to steal from well-stored houses. That is the law. And dolorously, Oliver Goldsmith sang, "The rich man rules the law, and the poor man grinds." It is this poor man, this last man, who is the sovereign, to whom this earth ought to belong. Will it belong to the politician or the peasant? The man who tills the land, or the man who owns, buys the land? What will be the basis of possession? I mean use. We don't believe in possession. but we believe in use. What will be the basis of distribution? Will it be purchasing power or necessity? Every revolutionary, every prophet of revolution, right from Karl Marx, has always said that things should belong to him who needs them, and not to him who can purchase. Defining the three objectives of revolution, the Third International held at Moscow in 1919 adumbrated 3 points: to end the domination of capital, to wipe out state boundaries, and to make war impossible. These have been enunciated in the clearest terms possible, both by Marx and others, other revolutionaries who came after him. I don't say his followers, but his successors. Followers and successors are not the same. There is a world of difference between the two. A follower just treads the same path that his master has trodden. But the successor finds out new pathways, explores new pathways. That's the work of the revolutionary. The revolutionary is not a mere follower. Once Kaka Sahib Kalelkar read to us a sentence from the life of Jesus Christ, wherein Christ says, when the author says, not knowing how to punish great men for their greatness, destiny punishes them with disciples. That is what followers do. They simply follow their master. They do not explore new pathways. But that, I think, is the first characteristic of a revolutionary. At the same time, the revolutionary doesn't believe that history has come to an end. I have been asked more often than not whether a revolution of the kind which J.P. envisages is possible. That's the politician's question. Politics has been defined as the art of the possible, while revolution has been defined as the art of making the impossible possible. Every event in history is regarded as impossible before it actually happens. History is not a tissue of repetitions. It's a record of unprecedented events, one after the other. And our country has always been a country of miracles. Miracles which caused the uttermost depression, and miracles that rouse the eternal hope in human breast. The first miracle which happened in my lifetime was India's independence. And the miracle that happened before that, which had caused tremendous hardship and agony to patriots in this country, was the establishment of British rule. Sir John Seeley has written a book, The Expansion of England. The book was prescribed to us when I was a student, and I was surprised out of my wits to read one sentence. We seem to have peopled and conquered half the globe in a fit of absence of mind. I thought to myself, if the globe could be conquered in a fit of absence of mind, perhaps we Indians were the most eligible people in the world, because no one else has been so absent-minded as we. So I began to peruse that book. I bought it and I began to peruse it. He says this was possible because 3/4 of the armies that conquered our empire consisted of Indians. And this could happen because there no feeling of a common nationality existed then. If the feeling of a common nationality began to arise only feebly, far from inciting the people to drive out the foreigner, it only roused a feeling that it was shameful to assist him in maintaining his dominion. From that day almost, our empire would cease to exist. So that was the first miracle. About 100,000 or 150,000 people coming from a distance of 6,000 miles ruled this country of 300 millions for about 150 years. I think it's we Indians alone who are capable of working such a miracle. This was the first miracle. And the second miracle was the conquest by India, achievement by India of freedom. Whoever may have brought it. I am not concerned with who brought it, but the way in which it was brought about. Goodwill on both sides. The representative of the British Crown became the first servant of Swaraj. This was another miracle. And then a third miracle happened in 1977 in the elections to Parliament. Our patient and common citizen is for the most part unconcerned, indifferent to what goes about him. But he has an uncanny way of making his existence felt on crucial occasions. This he made felt in the last elections in 1977. It was not a revolution in the ordinary sense of that, the traditional sense of that term, but it was a revolution in a different sense. When Marx published his Communist Manifesto in 1848, people thought the parliamentary method could not bring about social change. In fact, Marx called parliamentarism a saccharine doctrine, insipid. It was Engels who visualized a social change by parliamentary methods, democratic methods, constitutional methods. In his introduction to the French edition of the Capital, of Marx's Capital, Engels wrote, "In some European countries, there is near adult franchise. And in those countries, the majority of the citizens are those who labor. So a social revolution by other means than violence is possible in these countries. His prophecy didn't come true then. But as I said, our country is a country of miracles. The first communist government through the ballot box in the history of communism was established in Kerala in India. And again, a Marxist government has been installed in Bengal through the ballot box. So it's not the bullet alone that brings about social change. As a matter of fact, the bullet doesn't bring about any social change at all. It brings about a change in the masters. So I want to put a very pertinent question to you, for you to think over. I don't want an answer. As a matter of fact, this is a question which I share with you. What shall be the sanction of a democratic order? Whether force or consent? Whether a democratic social order will depend on the sword, on the force of the military, or the consent of the citizen? And we are trying to find out a way of bringing about social change through the consent and through the effort of the common men. Those who are downtrodden, those who are at a disadvantage, are the citizens who need an immediate and urgent social change. Those whom we know as the vested interests, who are prestigious in the present establishment, though they do not need any social change. Because any social change is bound to make them more, less prestigious than they are at present. So these are known as the vested interests. There are three symbols of these vested interests: power, as represented by the state; then police; and police, that is law courts, jails, and police department. And the third is the capitalist. So state, throne, and capital. These are the present values that are established, well established, firmly established in the present social order. We want to dislodge them. And we want to establish new values. So that is the second dimension. First dimension, as I said, is the changing of the context, changing the present social order. The second is change of values. Whether wealth will be regarded, as I said, whether purchasing capacity will be the basis of distribution, whether production will always be for sale, whether we will have an economy of exchange value or price, barter or price, it's the same thing. It's the same thing as purchase. Whether we shall have a different, entirely different kind of economy, an economy in which the basis of distribution is need and not purchase. Because as we know, all these are man-made values. It's the peasant who tills the land who is not man-made. The rich man with all his riches is man-made. The soldier is man-made. The king also is man-made. I am reminded of an article by H.G. Gardiner in which he has related some incidents of King Edward the VII's life. And he says, what's there in kingship to make it endurable? The marvel is not that so few men are kings, but so few kings, but any king has remained a tolerable man. What is there in kingship to make it tolerable? If a man no man in his senses would like to become a king if he could become a cobbler. Because these have been made by those who have the tools and implements of production in their hands. No soldier has ever manufactured his sword. No king has ever manufactured his throne. And no rich man, no capitalist has ever manufactured his coffers. It's the tools and implements that have manufactured the sword. And we have kept the man with the implements of production in delusion. We have always tried to make him feel that power lies with the king, the soldier, or the rich man, the capitalist. It's he, the last man, who has the weapons in his hands, not weapons, but tools and implements of production. And I think this has been symbolized in most of the symbols of revolutionaries in the world. I shall take for instance only three political parties in our country: the Congress, the Communists, and the Socialists of all persuasions. Now, what's the symbol on the flag of the Congress? It's the charkha. What's the symbol on the flag of the Communist? Not a revolver. Not even the bow and arrow of Sri Ramachandra or the mace of Sri Hanuman. And the symbol on the flag of the socialist is a pulley and a pulley and a plow. So it is the implements of production that indicate the aims of revolution. They have been presented to us as symbols of the revolution, the revolutionary order. So I think all our efforts should be directed towards increasing the strength and rousing the consciousness of the man who holds the plow, the man who wields the hammer and the sickle, the man who plies the charkha. It is who gives life. It is the implements of and instruments of production that give life. weapons are only devised with a view to take away life, not to give life. That is why the third point in the objects that were declared in the third international in 1919 was to make war impossible. You cannot, if you take resort to the sword to end the domination of capital and to put an end to the hypertrophy of the state, the sword will take the place of both capital and the throne and the state. So we have to find out a way of bringing about social change in which the sword will play no part. This is not a question of Gandhi or Marx. This is not a question of violence or non-violence. These are shibboleths. And let us steer clear of all shibboleths. Non-violence should not be elevated into a concept or a principle. When a law of life is elevated into a principle or a concept, it ceases to have any influence in life. If non-violence becomes a principle or a concept, people will kill each other in the name of non-violence, just as they have been killing each other in the name of God, in the name of truth, in the name of the Gita, in the name of the Quran. So, it's the attitude of the revolutionary that is most important. This was a dimension added to the technique of revolution by Gandhi. His genius demonstrated itself in his scheme of change of heart, the blessed theory, as they said, the thrice blessed theory of the change of heart, as the socialists used to ridicule. But now, since we have decided to bring about revolution in the context of democracy, our methods will not be only constitutional, they may be extra-constitutional, even anti-constitutional. Parliamentary absolutism and even constitutional absolutism are quite out of the place. There is such a thing as constitutional absolutism. Supposing there is a country which votes in favor of apartheid by a unanimous vote, will it be right? Is a unanimous vote of parliament the criterion of right or wrong? Even if the whole parliament unanimously votes in favor of preserving untouchability, it will not be right. It will be atrocious, diabolical. And we will have to oppose it stoutly. So this opposition will be peaceful, constitutional in the sense that it will not disregard the constitution, but it will preserve the spirit of the constitution, be calculated, it will be resorted with a view to increase the dignity of the constitution. That is the spirit in which we have to go about our work in this revolution. They have named it as total revolution. It is total in the sense that there should be revolution in all walks of life and in all realms of human consciousness as well. and it would be complete, not only total but also complete. Complete in the sense that it will leave as little room for counter-revolution as possible. So we have to explore a technique of revolution which will be complete in the sense that it will leave as little room for counter-revolution as possible. One last word and I have done. Friends, we are living in times which are not only strenuous but full of hope also. These are strenuous times, but these are also the most exhilarating times, in the sense that no problem is local. Every problem today becomes global. The world seems to have been brought at close quarters. And India, to me, is a world placed at close quarters. It has been placed at close quarters. A cyclone in Andhra Pradesh, a famine in Bengal, is not a local problem, but it rouses human consciousness throughout the world. So just as the present order has its dark side, it has also its bright side. And it's the bright side that should encourage us to go about our business. We are living in a world in which all boundaries of countries have ceased to have much meaning. I have been a schoolmaster. I was once teaching a class, geography. And I quoted Kipling's lines, "The East is East and the West is West," as was the fashion in those days, "and near the twain shall meet." There was a stripling, a boy of about 10 years, who stood up. He asked me, "Who was this poet?" I said, "It's Rudyard Kipling, Nobel laureate, one of the most eminent poets the English language has produced." Then he asked me a simple question, didn't he learn his geography? I said, "Why do you ask that question? Didn't he know that the world is round and there is neither east nor west? If you go east straight, from Japan you step into America, and if you go west from America you step into Japan, the land of the rising sun." So all these are geographical or astronomical fictions. The reality is there are no boundaries on the earth. Once I went from Trivandrum to Amritsar. The gentleman who introduced me was introducing in Hindi. He said, "Ye niche se aa rahe hain." He has come from below. I said, "I have been coming. My train was running on the surface of the earth. There was nothing niche. I didn't come from beneath the earth." He said, "Oh, I mean you came from the south. The south is niche in the map and not actually not on the earth itself." So we are more or less map-minded and not man-minded. It's the people of India whom we should love more than we love the land. Love of land is patriotism, and love of people is nationality. Johnson once said, "I can love everyone except an American. I can love all human beings except an American." So we can love all human beings except a Maharashtri. The Maharashtri can love all human beings except a Kannada or a Gujarati. Our neighbor is our worst enemy. By change of Congress, hard Gandhi meant converting your neighbor into your brother. Because we make our friends, we make our enemies, but it's chance that makes our next door neighbor. And he therefore is the strangest specimen of humanity meted out to us. Strange as the rain. Because he may be anybody, he is everybody. And we are obsessed. So Gandhi defined Swadeshi as neighborliness. And all scriptures all over the world have asked us to love our neighbor as ourselves. I wondered why should scriptures have to ask us to do this? Because the most difficult thing in this world to love is to love your neighbor. And we in this country have been living as neighbors, but never as brothers. We have been living side by side, but never living together. That is why, in spite of India being regarded by tradition as one country, the people of this country have been divided not only on the basis of race, on the basis of customs, costumes, creeds, but also on the basis of language. So we are lapsing into multinationalism. From denominationalism into multinationalism. There was an interim period during the days of British rule when the development of a common nationality seemed around the corner. But we are now returning back to our old ways and dividing this country into small nationalities with emergent particular regional parochial identities. And we are celebrating these identities, these parochial identities. So in an age when the whole world is coming closer together, we are perhaps regressing towards an age when each nation lived as a sequestered pool, quite far away, from cut off from the main current. Robinson Crusoe was written by Daniel Defoe, and I shall close this rather long-winded speech with a quotation, an apt quotation from Daniel Defoe. I shall not kill the crew. Though I don't like the crew, I shall not sink the ship. On the other hand, in times of danger and crisis, I shall try to save it at the cost of my life. Because you see, we are all in the same craft and must swim or sink together. That, I think, is the message. That, I think, is the politics of the people, as different from the politics of the politician. I must apologize in the end for such inadequacy of expression as I may have been guilty of, because I am speaking in a language which I speak very rarely. Though I like all languages in the world, I have no aversion to any language in the world. All languages under the sun are God's languages. Perhaps even the braying of the horse is loved by God. So I like every language that is spoken by man. But it is impossible for us to learn every language in the world. And as I live in the north, I am seldom called upon to address an audience in English, which I have done today with such effort as I, with such command as I was capable of. So with apologies to all of you and thanks to all of you, I close.
On behalf of this gathering of advocates, I thank Dada Dharmadhikari for visiting us today and giving us this brilliant talk. I can see now, I have realized that Dada Dharmadhikari is no ordinary man. He is a great intellectual and a great patriot. I have been able to understand the Catholicity of his outlook, whether it be in the matter of language or geography or any other matter that divides man, from geographical unit, one geographical unit from another geographical unit. I have also understood that Dada Dharmadhikari, notwithstanding his profession of, want of proficiency in this in English language, has delivered his speech in language which I have been able to appreciate and admire. If the thoughts were profound, the expression was super and extremely appropriate. These words could only emanate from a leader of the caliber and stature of Dada Dharmadhikari. I do not like to embarrass the Dada by showering any more praise upon him. We admire him. We love him.